Hello out there, and welcome to episode 64 of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
And we are your co-hosts for this episode. As this episode goes to air, it will be April 16th, 2018, Monday, April 16th, 2018. Hopefully, Will, you have completed your taxes.
Yes, of course.
But actually, this is strangely, you have, as most, not most, all Americans that haven't filed for an extension, you have until tomorrow, the 17th. Do you have an understanding as to why we have till tomorrow at midnight?
No, I don't.
So tax day is normally the 15th of okay. April, as we know, which is was yesterday.
Yep, which is also our friend Sunday. Mike Jamal's birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's always on tax day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, hey, Jamal. And so, so it's Sunday, so you can't have it due on Sunday. And today is actually Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C. So it's observed, so it can't, the tax day can't be today. So it has to be tomorrow when D.C. is open. The federal district is open.
Okay.
Today is also Patriots Day, which is a commemoration of what?
Tom Brady.
Isn't that bad? Like, aren't we supposed to be Falcons fans? Like, why would, like...
I'm just joking around. But, yeah. Patriots Day.
Patriots Day commemorates the battles of Lexington and Concord. Awesome. So, just a... And you know what... Do you know what tomorrow is, aside from being the actual tax day? What's tomorrow? It's a significant in my life.
April 15th?
April 17th.
I don't know. Is that when you left the firm?
No. April 17th, 2016 represents the first date that Danielle and I went on at Java Jive.
And Danielle is?
Daniela is my lady.
Oh, your girlfriend?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know who she is. I'm joking.
But she doesn't listen. So, like, she's.
Oh,
like,
right. She doesn't. Yeah, she doesn't. Plus, even if she heard this, she would not care.
Yeah.
She's like, Brazilian, and she would be like, whatever.
What is this? I do not care. They make fun all day.
She doesn't. She sounds exactly like that.
That's exactly it.
It's 100%.
I thought she was in the room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Today's episode, we have brought back Richard Mollett. Who's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition, LTCCC. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving care for seniors and the disabled through legal and policy research, advocacy, and education. Their website is www.nursinghome411.org. I highly suggest that if you have a loved one who is about to go into a long-term care facility or assisted living or has dementia, that you check out their website. They have a ton of information on there.
Webinars, fact sheets,
that
data.
It's all free.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a policy and advocacy group that is behind the elderly and long-term care residents and the disabled.
And we're super happy to have him on the show. Richard, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me again. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about issues that are very important to me.
Absolutely, man. We had a great time last week. You run out of time. You know what I mean? So, like, we were really super happy that we can get you back. A lot of great things to talk about.
Yeah, and I wanted to catch back up. What we were talking about. We had been talking about there's this three phase CMS regulation rollout 2016, 2017. 2018, each one.
2019, I'm sorry.
Oh, 2019.
It's been actually 2 years.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, right. So, and what we were discussing is that CMS has decided at the request of the CMS, an organization which is supposed to be on the resident side, has accepted the request of the nursing home industry to delay these regulations. So what does that mean?
Well, it's very interesting, and I think that we'll see what it means as that is rolled out. So, as we were talking last time, the Nursing Home Reform Law, which was part of OBRA 1987, that is still in place, and that has not been repealed, and that is the nexus of all resident care and resident rights in this country. I think it's important to understand and to mention, I should say, that all states have to follow federal regulations. So virtually everything that I always work on as an advocate and as a researcher, it's all focused on the federal requirements, which is what we're talking about today. It's important for people to know, I think, that states can have additional requirements, but they're not allowed to have less requirements than what we're talking about. So, for instance, in the federal law, nursing home staffing is so important. I mean, everyone recognizes that. Study after study has recognized that staffing levels are probably the most important component or most important criteria for assessing whether nursing homes providing good care. The federal requirement is that nursing homes have sufficient staffing.
Right.
There's not a set number, but many states have gone further and they've said we expect to have at least this minimum number.
Mm-hmm.
But the states can't take away any of the requirements that we're talking about. So what's happening now is that we have these federal requirements. We had regulations that came out in 1992, and then those regulations were tweaked here and there over the course of the years. But in 2015, CMS said, you know what, we're going to completely revise and reorganize those regulations. So again, the standards themselves have not changed. But I would say that they've been refined a little bit based upon our understanding of how people with dementia, how they live, that they're not just a zombie, as I think we often talked about, often looked at people 30 or 40 years ago, before my time, or that they could be restrained, chemically restrained or physically restrained with tie downs, et cetera. That we understand, this is not a humane way to treat people. So that's a reflection, I would say, in the new regulations. But again, it is important for people to know that the basic standards, the prohibition against physical restraints and chemical restraints, that has not changed since the early 1990s. So what's going on now is we have this regulatory change that's being implemented over a 3-year period, started in 2016 and 2017, last November, a couple months ago, was phase 2, and then phase 3 is November of 2019. So again, the basic standards, the residents' rights to good care, to be free of antipsychotic drugging, to be free of abuse, to live with dignity, those have not changed. It's just really how we are, I think, finessing or understanding some of those standards. And so in addition to that being rolled out, you had mentioned before, it might have been last week, that the F tags are changing and the guidelines are changing as well. So the regulations, as I've been saying, they provide the basic standards. They say you cannot give someone chemical restraints. You cannot give someone physical restraints. There are those you just can't tie someone down for the convenience of staff.
Sure, absolutely. And can you explain what F tags are? Because if you're not a surveyor or an advocate or an ombudsman, I don't think that most resident families understand.
I was just going to do that. So the standards are there from the nursing reform law. The regulations spell out that you have to ensure that residents are treated with dignity, that a resident gets to choose his or her own doctor. There's a host of regulations. And then on top of that, the way that those regulations are implemented, and by implemented I mean how they translated from being words on paper in the Federal Register to being in the lives of residents and realized in the lives of residents, are in two ways. One is through the, as you mentioned, the FTEG system. So for each regulatory standard, is what's called a federal tag or an F tag. And what that essentially means is that CMS has assigned a number to that regulatory standard. It's like F-252 or F-517, et cetera. And the reason why that is important, and important for families and residents and the public to know, is that if you go on to Nursing Home Compare, or if you go into your nursing home, either way, you can get a copy of the latest statement of deficiencies. And what that is that when a nursing home is inspected, there is a statement, you know, a written record of any of the citations or what the federal government calls deficiencies that were found. And each deficiency is associated with an FTEC. So that can help you, even someone who is just going to visit a facility to see whether they want to place their loved one there, or they're in the facility, if you're a family member or a resident. So that's really valuable. Usually you'll find the statement of deficiencies has to be made available for anyone who comes to the nursing home, including residents and families. Oftentimes it's at the front desk, but it should be, you know, optimally should be in a binder or something, you know, by the front of the building rather than behind the front desk. The reason why I mention that is because sometimes the facility will put it behind the front desk because they want to make it harder for people to find.
Right. And to explain to some of our listeners, what Richard's talking about, and I'm not sure if we've done a podcast on this or not, but there are, as far as deficiencies, there are severity levels, no actual harm with potential for minimal harm, all the way to immediate jeopardy to resident health or safety. And then the scope of the deficiency is either that it is an isolated incident, a pattern, or it's widespread. So when you look at these deficiency statements, you can see the specific category of, you know, whether it's F, whatever, that has to do with dietary, you know, guidelines, and that it's a widespread problem where nobody's getting enough calories or something. So that's important to know. But why do you think that, why are they changing the FTAG structure? I understand that a lot of people were frustrated with that. Why are they doing that?
You know, I don't know why. I don't know why they did that, to be honest. I think it was, you know, we had spoken last time about the changes to the regulations and whether those are really necessary. And I think a lot of us were frustrated that they made these changes to the regulations. Again, the standards are there, but think about it. I mean, when we all do our work, we know that there are certain things we can count on. You sit down at night in front of the TV and you turn the TV on, you know what channel is NBC, you know what channel is ESPN or CNN or Fox News, whatever. You know what those channels are. If someone were to come and scramble up your whole TV, you can imagine it would be kind of frustrating and difficult to figure out. So think about that in terms of a nursing home surveyor who is generally only there for, say, 3 or 4 days for the entire year.
Right.
And the system that they've been using for, you know, for a couple of years or sometimes for 10 or 20 years has now completely changed in terms of the regulatory language and the guidelines, which we'll talk about in a moment, if that's okay, and the FTAG. I used to know, you know, if I was a surveyor, I know as a researcher, if I come in and I see someone is receiving drugs unnecessarily, that's a chemical restraint that was F-222. I knew right away. So I didn't have to waste my time looking up and seeing, oh, what's the new FTAG? So, to get back to your point about the scope and severity, which is so important, that we've done studies, the Government Accountability Office has done studies, other research, academic researchers have done studies over the years that have found that persistently the state surveyors tend to undersite facilities, both in terms of their scope and in terms of their of the severity of a problem. So even when they identify a problem, which problems tend to be under-identified in nursing homes, they also have a significant tendency to underscope it and under-identify it in terms of severity. And what that means is that unless they can, in their minds, prove that something is widespread, they will say it only affected a couple of people. And what you'll see, and what I see when I do research on this, is that one of those statement of deficiencies said that 4 out of 5 people reviewed had, say, inappropriate antipsychotic drugging with, you know, there's no clinical indication for receiving these dangerous drugs. They'll say that was limited because it was only 4 people. And what we have been saying to CMS for decades is that, look, you have to base your evaluation on what you looked at. And if 80%, 4 out of 5 of those residents that you looked at had this problem, then that is a widespread problem. Either you find that it's widespread based upon that, or you expand the scope of your inquiry to make that determination. And the reason why this is so important, just as a general proposition, is that unless a deficiency is identified as having caused harm or immediate jeopardy, a nursing home will almost never be fined. Nursing homes are almost, even though they can be fined, they're almost never fined unless the surveyor has substantiated that there is, you know, significant harm or immediate jeopardy to a resident. And this is something, because we're so concerned about it, we have been focusing on more and more. So I did research, for instance, 2 years ago now, that looked at the extent to which states are citing. And what we found was that states, when they cite for a healthcare violation in a nursing home, they only identify that as causing any harm to a resident 5% of the time. Now, how is that possible? We even found that, like, when they find that there is a pressure ulcer. Now, you know, I'm sure your audience has an idea. You know, pressure ulcers are serious injuries.
Yeah. We talk about them frequently.
The resident, I'm sorry?
I'm saying we talk about those frequently, yeah. So yes.
So even when they find that there is a pressure ulcer, and even when they make the connection that there was poor pressure ulcer monitoring and care, they only find resident harm about 25% of the time. Now, how can that? Obviously, I'm an advocate. I take a strong position for enforcement and for good quality care, but I cannot understand for the life of me how, if you identify poor pressure ulcer care leading to a pressure ulcer, how that is not harmed 100% of the time.
Yeah, that's why
the work of advocates, including attorneys, is so important, because we need to have some accountability. Because again, if it's not cited at a level of harm and there's not a penalty associated with it, what you are saying is it's okay for you to do this.
Yeah, and the problem is, like a lot of corporations, when they consider lawsuits for torts that they might commit, it's a balancing act. You know, what's the cost of making sure this doesn't happen versus the cost of dealing with it if it does happen? And it seems like they have figured out, look, we don't, you know, we can cut back on staffing so that people aren't getting turned every 2 hours. We can, you know, cut back on other things that might help prevent bed sores. Because at the end of the day, we're not really getting fined all that much. And it's, you know, it's worth the occasional lawsuit for us, which is a horrible way to look at it. But that's the way that they do. You talked about the guidelines. With regard to these guidelines, these guidelines are still there. Are they not being enforced in general?
Well, so again, we have the nursing reform, but we have the regulations that, you know, spell out what the basic expectations are. And what the guidelines are is that's a description of exactly what is expected. And the guidelines are really geared to surveyors, what they should be seeing in terms of compliance for each of those regulatory requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But as CMS says, they are also important for nursing homes, obviously, and CMS has said that they're important for residents and people who work with them to know what the expectations are. So a guideline, you know, for instance, to get back to the antipsychotic drugging, the regulation says no use of chemical restraints, no unnecessary drugs. The guidelines say that that if someone is given an antipsychotic drug because they're a danger to him or herself, as I mentioned last week, two things have to happen. This is the guidelines say that we expect to see that there's gradual dose reduction, that the facility is taking immediate steps to reduce the level of drugs, and two, that there are non-pharmacological approaches being implemented. And by that, I mean not using drugs, but instead evaluating what is going on with this resident. Why is he or she, you know, behaving in a certain way, crying or spitting? So what is setting that off? Is it something that happens in the afternoon? Is it something that happens with an approach to care, like when she when we want to give her a bath or want to wake her up for something. What is going on and how do we address that? So that's what the guidelines say, and that's why the guidelines are so important. So if an inspector came in, you know, somebody came in, and they see someone is on antipsychotic drugs, what they are supposed to do is then say, okay, let me look at the clinical record. Let me talk to the resident, if possible, and a family member and say, is your resident receiving non-pharmacological approaches? Is the facility evaluating what is going on with her? Maybe she has a urinary tract infection, which is, you know, something that happens quite frequently. Are they looking at other things that could be going on and trying other things to address those issues? So those are what the guidelines do. And those guidelines have been around since the 90s, but all of those guidelines also changed. And I, as well as Consumer Voice representatives, were on the CMS work group that developed the new guidelines. And those guidelines, importantly, the change guidelines, came out also in November of last year. And that's why some of these issues are so important. Again, we had the regulatory changes that just came out. The regulations, with, you know, phase two was November of 2017, a couple months ago. New guidelines went into effect November of 2017. The whole new FDAC system went into effect November of 2017. And CMS changed how inspections are conducted, and that went into effect November of 2017. And then on top of it, we have the Trump administration that is also pulling back on some of these things. So it's a very, you know, a treacherous time, to be honest. But, you know, we wanted to talk about, you know, about the survey system as well. I wanted to tie in for everyone, you know, how these things are coming together. It's all happening right now, you know, laid out starting November of 2017. So just a couple of months ago, that all these major changes were taking place. And then on top of it, we have some backpedaling, some diminishment going on by the Trump administration.
So are the changes taking place there, but there are just no monetary penalties?
Correct. So for some of those, some of the regulatory standards, the nursing home industry lobbyists said, the nursing home industry has always argued that standards are too high and that they don't get enough money to meet those standards. I mean, I'm in my 50s, but from before my time, 40, 50 years ago, you know, I read old documents, and they say exactly the same thing that we hear right now.
Right.
That is just, you know, that is something that's worked, from my perspective, it's worked for the industry, I should say. From my perspective, it's a way for the industry to essentially hold our loved ones hostage. Mm-hmm. That they take in a resident. They are, as I mentioned last week, they are required, when they take someone in, they are required to meet those standards. And then they say, oh, but we don't get enough money.
Right.
But we're still holding on to your mother. That's the part that just doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. You know, they're still holding on. They're still getting paid, you know, a couple $100 or more a day generally to provide that care. They just don't do it. And because of that powerful lobby, they're able to get away with it.
Yeah, that's a shame. And it seems like, in all honesty, to be somewhat politically neutral here, it seems like this is a problem for both sides. Certainly the new administration is siding with the nursing home industry, but these problems have been going on for a while. So, you know, I blame all parties involved. I really do. I don't understand why. You know, you would think that elder Americans would be a common interest for all people, but they're not. They're really not.
I think people don't understand the importance of nursing home care until they actually need it. And there was actually a study that came out about a year ago that found that if you live to be, you know, in your late middle age, like late 50s, you have over a 50% chance of needing nursing home care at some point.
I want to talk about this because I was reading a couple of the things that on your website, and that one blew my mind. And I've been dealing with nursing homes for about 16 years, but 40% of those over the age of 65 are going to require nursing home care. That is a huge number.
And as I said, it actually is higher than that. There was a new study that came out last year that found, you know, based upon the data, that it's actually higher than 40%. It's over 50%.
I mean, with a number like that, it just seems absurd to me that we don't have some of the best nursing homes on the planet, and we have the exact opposite, some of the worst. But I also want to talk about something else that from your website that I was reading about that's really interesting, and it's about assisted living homes. Can you talk about, because we've got about 5 minutes left, can you talk about what's going on with the problem with assisted living homes and how they might be a little different than nursing homes?
Sure. So, you know, because nursing homes have for many years have had such a bad reputation, and you're right, this is a book, you know, it's not just a Donald Trump issue or Republican issue, it's really all sides that we, you know, as I mentioned last week, we're outnumbered. We're small groups, you know, a few small groups that work on this nationally. Most states don't have a state, you know, advocacy group that's working for them. There's the Amazon program, which more helps on the individual level. So that's, again, a very powerful lobby that exists, you know, year in and year out, whether it's a Republican or Democratic administration. So we are faced with that in terms of, you know, advocating for residents' rights, et cetera. Excuse me. Now I completely lost my train of thought again. I apologize.
That's okay. We were talking. We wanted to talk about this new federal landmark study.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So as I was saying, so nursing homes have historically been, you know, very institutional. They have a very poor, I would say, deservedly poor reputation in terms of not being good places to live or to get care.
Yeah.
So more and more people have turned to assisted living because the promise of assisted living is that me or my loved one can live safely here, but in an environment that's more home-like, that is more centered on resident dignity and independence, et cetera. And we've done studies on this over the years, but there's a new, brand new study, I would say a landmark study that came out last week from the Government Accountability Office that found that there are actually a significant a number of problems of what they call critical incidents in assisted living that receive very little attention. And in a nutshell, what we found over the years is that more and more people were going to assisted living that had significant needs, almost to the point of a nursing level needs, but they wanted to avoid nursing home care. Oftentimes that's private pay, but more and more states are furnishing or providing opportunities for people on Medicaid to go into assisted living rather than a nursing home.
It says here that Americans are spending more than $10 billion per year to fund people living in these assisted living facilities. That is a lot of money.
Oh, and that's just Medicaid.
Yeah. What is a critical incident?
Oh, so a critical incident, well, what GAO did, the Government Accountability Office did is, you know, let's try to get an idea of what's going on here. And a critical incident is something that is, you know, gives you a rough idea of what it is. I mean, there is a definition, but it could be physical abuse, it could be sexual abuse, it could be emotional abuse, it could be, other things that happen, you know, a fall, et cetera. What GAO actually found is that different states identify critical incidents differently. So the point of this and the importance of the GAO report was they looked to see, well, let's find out what's going on with the assisted living because, you know, the government's paying a lot of money now. People are depending upon it more and more, both private pay and government pay. Let's find out what's going on. And what they found out is that states don't even track, you know, most states, I should say, don't seem to be tracking what is going on in assisted living or monitoring it very effectively. So they used this, you know, idea of critical incident, which could be a range of things. It said, what do you define as a critical incident and what are you tracking? And most states could not even report on that.
Right.
Anything. And then those states, there are 48 states that provide Medicaid assisted living. And that was, you know, so those were the 48 states that responded. And of those, I think 22 were able to say we're tracking these critical incidents, but some of them define them differently. Sure. And some states only reported one for the entire year. The study focused on 2014. There were some states only reported one, but there were over 20,000 incidents that were reported just in this, you know, 22 states just related to the Medicaid delivery. So this just gives you, I think, it's kind of a tip of the iceberg idea of what is going on in assisted living. And the industry has, again, been extremely powerful in ensuring that there's no federal standards, no federal safety standards or healthcare standards for assisted living, and that the state standards tend to be very low. State enforcement tends to be even lower in terms of inspections and in terms of citations, et cetera, for assisted living as there are for nursing homes. So an assisted living, in short, can be great or it can be not so great, but it's really, you know, it's copycat enter, you know, it's buyer beware.
Yeah.
You could find someplace that's good or you could find someplace that's bad. And a really quick anecdote is I happened to be in an assisted living a couple weeks ago visiting the day before this GAO report came out, and it was a lovely assisted living. It looked kind of like a Hilton Garden Inn or, you know, a nice hotel that you would stay at. And when I went inside, it was fine. We came across a resident with dementia who had her keys on a necklace and her room number on a necklace, and she was standing outside her door, and she could not remember how to get into her room. And she finally figured it out, and you know, she figured out how to put the key into the door. What was the key? How to put it in the door. And then she could not figure out how to get the key out. And if she hadn't been helped, if we hadn't been there, I think she would have strangled herself. No. Nobody came, because unlike a nursing home, we have a nursing station, et cetera. Nobody else was in the hallway except the two of us. And I watched as this woman, the door swung open, and her neck was still attached to the door handle, and she couldn't figure out how to get it out. And if we hadn't been there, goodness knows what could have happened to her.
We had a very tragic case about a year ago where a man with dementia ended up strangling himself on accident. It is very dangerous, and it certainly happens. And that's even more disheartening that it's in an assisted living facility.
Yeah, that's what it highlights your point that it can be sometimes more dangerous when you have an individual that's not that should not be in an assisted living facility that's there. I mean, it creates a more hostile environment for them.
Yeah.
But Richard, lots of great information this episode. We really appreciate you again coming back. Again, for the listeners out there, your website,
nursinghome411.org, couldn't be any easier to remember. We're going to do everything that we can to get attention.
It's a fantastic website, lots of great information. But other than that website, Richard, how can people get what you're throwing at them and follow you on the social media?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is LTC Consumer. So there's two C's, LTC. Consumer. And then on Facebook, which I encourage everyone who's on Facebook to join us, it's Facebook.com/LTCCC, Larry Thomas Carroll. And we post a lot of good stuff up there. Everything, again, that we have on our website is absolutely free. So, and we have some, just mentioned very quickly, since we spoke about assisted living, we have some very old guidebooks. They're from 2002. So they look a little bit dated, but they're really good if you're living in or thinking about an assisted living. Just do a search for assisted living or guidebook on our website. They're absolutely free, and they help people to think about, you know, what they want when they go to assisted living and how they can achieve that.
Awesome, man. Well, you're fighting the good fight. I really enjoyed talking with you, and we wish you the best of luck. And you're more than welcome to come on anytime you want, because there is a lot of material to cover, and who knows what's going to happen with this administration with so many other topics that affect long-term care residents.
Well, thank you again so much for inviting me. I really appreciate the work that you're doing, and then also getting this out to people. It's so valuable that people know what their rights are and what they can do.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Sure. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Richard is now has joined. I don't know. I can't remember. Saturday Night Live has the Five Timers Club. Richard is in the Two Timers Club.
Yes, that's right.
For two times a guest.
Yeah, and hopefully he'll be back again. Yeah. Lots of good information.
Yeah.
But.
So anyway, I'm really, like, again, we encourage everybody to not only listen, but you can also watch the episodes. And again,
yeah.
You know, for as an added treat, last week we began instituting, under Gene's insistence, that we need two different cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a GoPro set up
mm-hmm.
on the side of the table here that is capturing kind of like a, not behind the scenes, because it's not behind us, because that would be weird, on the sidelines kind of vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that you wanted that, you asked and you receive as yes. a listener. You know,
yeah.
we're responsive. Like you, outpouring of, hey, what is the right side of Will's face look like?
We have no idea if that even works.
I think it will work. Okay. I think that you know, we got our fingers crossed. I can't even get like you know my telephone to work, and my yeah. screen is cracked.
Right.
You know. Like, I paid whatever, and the screen cracks immediately.
Well.
Anyway.
And speaking of crack, let's...
Let's crack this up. Let's crack the whip on wrapping this up. Anyway, guys, thanks again for watching, for listening, for consuming the Nursing Home Podcast in any form that you consume it through. You can always watch us on nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Is that nursinghomeabusepodcast.com? Or our YouTube channel, or you can check us out on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher
whatever, any of them.
Out on the streets.
Yeah.
On your radio. And with that, folks, we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and feel free to leave us some feedback. And for more information about the topics discussed in this episode, check out the show website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. That's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.